But with apologies to charity, you will have heard some of this before.
I don't remember any of it.
That's good. Where am I? Okay, so there's a Gemara of Mitzia in the midst of a fascinating Gemara that is worth extensive conversation in its own right. This is the prelude to the story of how Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish met, which itself is part of a interesting conversation about Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, I think. And it's a worthwhile framework to have the conversation about, for having the conversation about what Talmudic stories about rabbis are, and particularly about whether one ought to take them, not just literally, but whether one ought to take them biographically, right? Whether one thinks that the stories in the Talmud are actually supposed to be representing something about the specific rabbis, or whether there was simply was a genre which everyone knew, which was telling stories about rabbis as emblematic figures as opposed to as historical figures. I believe Rabbi Lazar Bishimon is one who has something like 32 buckets of fat removed from his body and left out in the sun to see if they rot, because he knows that tzaddikim, right, tzaddikim don't decompose, and they don't, so he's all cheered, but then 20 years after he dies and he's up in the attic, his wife visits him and discovers one worm. You take it for yourself whether you think this story is intended to be literal or not. But it's important because people take that story, people have read, but the Rav Yochanan Reish Lakish story, people do take literally. When you recognize that the Rav Yochanan Reish Lakish story is part of this story, then you may be less inclined to take the Rav Yochanan Reish Lakish story historically as well. Or you may not be. Any case, but as part of this, there is a statement of Rav Yochanan which itself may be intended to be historical or not, which Rav Yochanan said, "Ano ish tairi mishapira Yerushalayim. I am left of the beautiful people of Yerushalayim." Once upon a time, there were beautiful people in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yochanan is the last one left. Okay, it's the he's the Shimon HaTzadik of the beautiful people of Yerushalayim. Now, after that comment, there is this fascinating Aramaic editorial interposition. So, what did you make of that? There, Ora. What is that interposition doing? Why is it there, Ora? So one, the comment after after Rabbi Yochanan's statements, right? So then the editor starts talking. Right? So what is the purpose of the editor? So that's really, he's giving you
like a complete abstract.
A complete abstract, right? That's very cool, right?
Let's represent him, which
doesn't. Right. So I think that's absolutely right. Right? It gives you, right, if you want to, well, does it represent Rabbi Yochanan or it represents the quality of Rabbi Yochanan? Right?
Quality.
That's a fascinating, right? That beauty is a transferable thing so that you can look at a color and say that is, it doesn't mean Rabbi Yochanan was that color. Presumably. And it's not literal, it's that you want to know what Rabbi Yochanan's complexion was. Right? This is the color of Yochanan's complexion. Right? It's a representation. All right, good. So why is it here? Why do we need to know this?
To understand what the people of Yerushalayim were like?
So it's a way, because otherwise we just make a claim that people of Yerushalayim were beautiful and we wouldn't know what that meant. Now, we could say, guess what? There are other beautiful people in the world. Right? There are other beautiful people in the world, and we could look at the people of Sweden. Right? That's what the people of Yerushalayim used to look like the people of Sweden. Now they don't. But maybe not. Maybe that would trivialize it, because really people of Yerushalayim were more beautiful. And so we need an abstraction to represent it. Yes, Yehuda?
Well, in my shiur today with Mishabah HaKayt, we were discussing the concept of mashal and how, like, sometimes the mashal itself raises more problems than what it seemingly was supposed to be reconciling within the text. And maybe so too, this is supposed to be sort of like the Edgar's note is supposed to be appreciated in its own right, as well as like an elucidation on the original.
And what is it? What is it? What is it about in its own right?
Well, I think my speculations might be too unfounded, but I mean, I think it's supposed to actually be making you appreciate Hashem.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, it's describing all of these, the pomegranate and the roses and the sun and the shade and its radiance, all of these things which are not human creations. And then it's saying, look how great are these creations, like he had a phallic.
Interesting. Why isn't the silver cup a human creation?
Right. It's, I don't know if that's a stretch, but I definitely think it's working in the same way that a mashal would work.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'm willing to accept that. It's another point we can talk about the meaning of red roses in Chazal, because I think that you can find specific meanings for red roses in Chazal. Yes?
Okay, I got it. I'm saying maybe it's trying to do what the picture of the Yavid's father was doing, like showing what was it like to be in the presence of a Yochanan.
Okay, right, it's to give you the experience. Right? You should know what it was like, right? The experience for Yochanan was like being in the presence of... Okay, so now I shall ask you a somewhat different question. Or is it, this is not based on what you remember?
No, this is not based on what
you remember. Okay, good, yes.
Perhaps it's here to teach us that all the beauty we could ever want or find in the world can be found in the Torah.
In the Torah?
Because Rabbi Yochanan, right, Rabbi Yochanan is here representing the Torah.
So that's cool, right? So Rabbi Yochanan is, right, that's very cool, right? To teach you that I don't think Rabbi Yochanan's beauty was something that was, you know, that was separate from the world. It was just the epitome of... That's very beautiful. Good. So now I have a different question. Miriam,
yes.
Do you think the editor of this sugya would understand Rothko?
I have no idea.
Do you understand why I'm asking the question?
I understand why you would have that Havamina, but I don't think that the good has for you.
Good. Spell out the Havamina, please.
We
won't. We'll say it on the tape officially. This is a Havamina which Miriam Jaffe does not endorse.
Does not necessarily.
Not necessarily endorse. And we're not even stating whether it's plausible or not.
well, that Rothko is the idea is that. It represents something not as normal art, which tries to mimic what it's representing, but that it's two different things representing one thing, which is very different than something else, representing it based on colors and shapes. And so too, this mashal is a representation in colors and various different objects, which have nothing to do with Rabbi Yochanan, are supposed to represent.
Okay, good. And if not Mukroch, because?
Because, I mean, it could be that this mashal is, it could be there's some, more metaphorical significance to these particular things, that what Rothko is more about shapes and colors giving you emotion, that this figure is about, like you were saying before, what red roses mean in Gemara. It could be that, I don't know, it's talking about beauty, and this image equals beauty, equals Rabbi Yochanan in beauty level, whereas the Rothko is, again, about inducing emotions and stuff, and things representing things.
Okay.
So there are various other ways to read.
Okay. I want to suggest that the most... Well, I think first a close reading of the sugya. So you have to be careful, because the sugya doesn't claim that the whole tableau represents Rabbi Yochanan's beauty. It claims that just the color... Right, the pieces are a hechitimsa to produce the color. Right, it's just the color, right? And you could look at that color and you could say, it's just painting pure beauty. Or you could not. It's also possible that it's all a metaphor. It's also possible it's all a metaphor, and we just don't get the metaphor yet, which happens. Okay, I want to ask you another question. Here's a hypothetical. There's a guy, he spent his entire life learning nothing but Gemara. Nothing. Now, I guess, nothing but Gemara. Spent his life reading Gemara, learning Gemara, maybe a little occasional Chumash. Has never seen anything more visually complicated than the Daf of Gemara, and probably hasn't even seen that because he learned about that. Right, so probably.
So wait, does he live? When does he live?
Oh, he lives just about the time the editor of this sugya, shall we say?
Okay,
which we're going to presume for our sake is quite
late. He
knows Aramaic. Yeah, he knows Aramaic. Let's talk to him orally, right? But he's uninterested in visual experience. Okay, and he reads a statement. The statement says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ano Ishtari Mishapira Yerushalayim. And he says to himself, what's that like? Well, I know what it's like. I'm going to take a silver cup fresh from the smithy, fill it with the seeds from a pomegranate, surround it with red roses, place it in the sun of the shade, and I'll produce a kind of radiance. And that radiance will be... How plausible is that? Right.
So if he's not interested, he wouldn't bother doing it. If I cared, I would do it, but I don't care.
And so suppose all of a sudden he's struck. He's struck by the realization, wow, I need to recreate the experience of Rav Yerushalayim because he realizes it's a chiyuv of Zecher LeMikdash. Right? He has a halachic category. So he goes out, right? And he says, Atazot. Right? So he comes up with this image. What are the odds? That plausible? Do people just do that?
Yeah,
really? Do you think you're capable of it?
I don't know.
I would try this at home.
If you had never been, if you had never been interested, you don't want any of the silver cups in my house. They've been dropped too often. Their services are
murdered. Never underestimate the concreteness of
Yeshua's offer. No, I'm not asking. What I'm asking you is the editor of this sugya. What are the odds that the editor of this sugya had not spent? Had not spent significant time prior to writing the sugya arranging various objects so as to produce the experience of various colors.
You mean it wasn't only that was from Torah?
Whoever came up with it.
Oh, you're questioning, you really think that he did it?
I think that the editor of this sugya has to, I write, has
have
to.
Been playing around with the stuff he has at home.
I think that is thinking of somebody's...
I don't think so either. I think it's all
the beauty of this is that
it's
imagination.
Interesting.
I don't think it would look that great probably if you did it really. But
you don't think
is,
so.
Like, can you imagine what that would look like?
No,
it would totally spoil it if we went out and did it.
But I disagree. I don't think that it's just... I mean, I agree with you that it's not meant to be taken that he actually did this literally, but that each of these aspects, I really do think it's in a format and in a detail that each thing must be correlating with something else, that it can't just be, I mean, red pomegranates and red roses, like, we get, yeah, it must be, I don't know, I think it has to be deeper.
Well, also the possibility that red was simply the, he may have just been thinking of the best way of getting red, and red is just the symbolic representation of beauty in many cultures.
Uh-huh. But he wants to get a, he doesn't want
and
the red of the rose.
I'm looking it up online, and red—it's just red as a color means beauty in many cultures.
He doesn't want the rose, though.
He
doesn't want the pomegranate seeds.
He wants the best red.
He wants the best red. Now, who cares about the? Where does that notion of the best red come from?
Red
is a combination of concepts of red.
Now, it's possible that he read this somewhere. Right, he read, you know, that somewhere in a bathroom somewhere, somebody had left a copy of Art News, and in there was a description of how to get the best red. The only thing was copy that description, which he remembered from the bathroom, into the Gemara, so he could know that was what Rabbi Yochanan looked like. It's possible. And it's possible that this is all a fantasy, and it's actually written by somebody who's blind. But, right, you know, who has no idea, right, you know, who's just constructing something. And, you know, in fact, if you try this, what you get is some kind of really ugly purple or brown. Also possible that And to me, you look at this and you want to paint it. It's a still life. Right? That's what it is. It's a still life. Right? Somebody takes objects and places the objects and then wants to paint the object and the light coming off those objects. And the goal is to get the shade of light the perfect shade of light that is produced by combining these objects. Right? That's the goal. Yes, I think that the still life, as in many still lives, the objects are chosen symbolically. I think we can probably tell you that the seeds of the red pomegranate are mitzvot, right? Because we all know that afilu poshei Yisrael melei mitzvot kerimonim. And red roses are the beauty of Olam Hazeh in Chazal. And cups. We're talking about what cups are, what dafka silver cups are. But with all that, I find it very, very hard to believe either that this sugya was written by somebody who didn't take visual experience seriously, or that it was written with the expectation that it would be read by people who didn't take visual experience seriously. Yes.
I feel like you're conflating not taking visual, taking visual experience seriously with wanting to go out and make things.
Yeah.
I'm not sure those things actually can be tied together.
No, I don't think. I think that the editor, it's hard to imagine, to me, it's hard psychologically, but again, I have an alternate explanation.
Somebody who walks around the world and is wowed by the beauty of everything he sees, but that person could have no inclination to actually go and try to manipulate and make experiments for them like they're in a lab.
But he thinks about them.
What?
He thinks about combinations that he hasn't seen.
Everybody has amalgamations of associations that they...
Do they spend time thinking about them?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
Everybody?
A lot of people.
Do you spend time thinking about how to arrange objects to produce colors?
Not often. But I don't think that proves that the only people who do are people who have, like, an artistic... are the same people who have the intention to go out and paint things or sort of like make these assemblies physically. Gives these people a very vivid imagination.
Interesting empirical claim. I find it hard to imagine that people would. This is so detailed and so worked out that I don't know. To me, it's like calls out to you. Try it. It's never going to happen because there's never a light between. There's never an exact line between the sunlight and the shade. And if that's an imaginary point, and who knows? You know what stage of ripeness the pomegranates have to be in. And now we have so many shades of roses that who knows whether we have the right color red. That he had, and not only that, what purity of silver, and what kind of sheen. So yes, it's imaginary.
Or maybe that's the point.
That it's a purely imaginary thing.
Right, you can't recreate it.
Yes.
He just takes tropes of beauty.
Yes, it may be that what this is the combination of multiple representations of beauty, but that means you have to know. Right, you have to know what. What constitutes beauty? Yes, that's right. This could be. It could be that nowadays what he would say is paint a savannah with rolling hills and then put some buffalo in the middle of it. Right. And that's what Rabbi Yosef looked like, a painting from us in school. Thomas Eakins, whatever he said. That's what Rabbi Yosef looked like. That's what he would say nowadays. But even there, right? So the only reason you can talk about that is because you have, because you have a cultural reference. Okay, I hold. It's not, you know, the notion that this is a that this is a geometric proof is not is obviously not compelling. But it struck me. Right? It struck me when I read this that it was, and you can take that, you can experience it, so to speak, that the. It just struck me as an amazingly sophisticated and serious appreciation of certain kinds of visual stimuli that it seemed very unlikely to me would happen, but would be happenstance. I'm not a visual person that way. I'm not, but it's like, wow, this is something that, wouldn't it be awesome if you could just get that color? You know, but I can't see it in real life. It wouldn't be interesting in real life at all. It'd only be interesting in a painting. Wouldn't it be interesting if you could get just that color in a painting and people could look at it and say, wow, that's an experience of pure beauty. And maybe, you know, and we're talking about, you know, whether it's a qualified beauty in some sense, right? Because it's human beauty, but it's particularly, but the human beauty of Rabbi Yochanan is itself a challenging thing. What Rabbi Yochanan's beauty is, Rabbi Yochanan's beauty is at least, Rabbi Yochanan's beauty in this story, Rabbi Yochanan's beauty is an effeminate, right, is an effeminate male beauty. Because the context of it, we follow out in a moment, that the next moment Rabbi Yochanan is bathing and Rish Lakish mistakes him for a woman. Right, so Rabbi Yochanan's beauty is a particular kind of beauty. And we could try and, you know, we could try and frame it. You know, there are classical terms that we would use for it, some of which might be deeply troubling if we applied them to Rabbi Yochanan for that kind of beauty. Okay, I just wanted to put it out of state, right? I had to make the claim that the most likely possibility is that this sugya is written by somebody who has a rich appreciation of visual experience, and who thinks about it enough to bother to be able to come up with plausible ways of arranging objects so as to create colors. Granted that it's not demonstrable.
Well,
is it?
On the assumption that is a plausible way of arranging the object for us to produce the
color. Yes, but it says also possible this is a philosopher's, right? This is a philosopher's, you know, conception of what would produce color when in fact it produces nothing at all.
Right, or not even a philosopher, it's just like a fantasy of somebody.
Yes. Well, it's really
things, but it's never really played out.
Halachist imagination, or it could be an amalgam of items taken from popular culture, right, and with purely symbolic value, or for that matter, it could be a Kabbalistic thing that we don't understand, right, or a halo thing. We don't, okay? I just wonder what, it, you know, this is part of the question of whether we want to make a gadata meaningful. Right, if we want to make a gadata meaningful, so then, I got to figure what you do with this thing, but, you know, I don't want to make a gadata meaningful just by taking it literally, right? So that goes back to the realm we talked about. Right, and I think some of God says really not. So the God that Rabbi Jaffe talked about, of Rava walking into Bar Sheshach and seeing him in a pool of rose petals, right, surrounded by zonos. Right, so that's not such a great image, but Bar Sheshach, I think it's clear that Bar Sheshach is not my chiddush. The Bar Sheshach isn't the person. Sheshach is Bavel and not Bash, and that's already used in Tanakh. Right, and what's the story? He comes in, he sees him bathing in this pool, and a messenger comes in, and Bar Sheshach asks. We'll leave aside the question that it's his birthday, and he's sending him an avodah zarah, and all the endless halachic discussions about how he could send a korban to, and all that. That's all sorts of fun. But here, he walks in, and Bar Sheshach tells him, "Do you have zonot as beautiful? Right? Do you have women as beautiful as these?" Right? Which is a prust question, right? We say that's a prust, very unsanua question. Yeah, prust, unsanua. And his Hesbron says, "Yes, ours are more beautiful than yours." Right? That was the title of this when I gave this issue to Harvard Hill. Our huris are more beautiful than your huris. You know what huris are? Huris are the perpetual virgins who wait for you in heaven, right, in particular Islamic tradition. This is not an Olam Hazeh fantasy. Okay? And now what happens, right? So he says, ours are more beautiful than yours. Why? Because you have Shivan Malchios. And he says, no. I don't have Shivan Malchios. And then a messenger comes and says, the king wants you, and he gets whisked away. Right? If you saw this in Sipur of Nachman, you would recognize it. Right? So I think what's going on here, right, is the question of what is which is better, Olam Hazeh or Olam Haba? And one among other things, right? And right, what constitutes Olam Haba? And the claim is that what constitutes real Olam Haba is freedom from Shiva Malchus. But but how do you get freedom from Shiva Malchus and Olam Hazeh? Ain ben Chorin Olam Yishalom Eitara. Right. So the claim, right? So the right, the zonot and the rose petals represent everything you can get in Olam Hazeh. And Rava says that Rava, and Bavel represents represents everything you have in Olam Hazeh because they're the reigning empire. And right, and he says to him, right, is there even anything in Olam Haba, right, your religion which claims that our domination of this world is irrelevant, is there anything in Olam Haba which can compare to these? And the answer is yes. What we have in Olam Haba is better because we don't have Shivud Malchios. And not only that, right, you are the empire and we are the subjects, and yet we don't have Shivud Malchios, right, you have Shivud Malchios and we don't. Right, because we have something that frees us. We have Torah. Okay, that's what I think Vatagata says about. So I don't think Vatagata. I don't think Vatagata. You could tell me, look at Vatagata. Look, somebody has to have an active pornographic image, right? Imagination, right? To have imagined the zonot and the rose petals, right? Who thinks of baths full of rose petals? Of all things, like rose petals floating on the water, maybe, but entire baths of rose petals. But there, I think it's entirely symbolic. Pardon? A bull pit.
A ball pit.
Yes, that's why I'm putting it now. From the sublime to the trivial. So I'm open. I think that Vatagata tells you nothing whatsoever. In terms of what the about the psychology of the person in that way. But this one I have a temptation to take as somewhat more seriously that way. But I want to point out, right? I don't want to claim that the only way to make a goddess is meaningful is to take him literally. I think it would be a very serious mistake to take that a goddess literally. And I'm convinced that people in Malay Demim, I think, who have the idea that a goddess is written in a certain kind of code and it's possible to break the code. This was my example of an encoded a goddess that I think I solved. He has others. So I'm not in any way claiming. I think that probably you're all right that every component that I got it to of the image is symbolic, and yet it seems to me too compelling to not write for someone who doesn't care about the visual imagination. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, generally we think the editors of Shas matter, and they're reasonable role models. So it's hard for me to square that with the position of Rashi and the Rid. I can claim that, well, this is not Maaseh Yedei Adam, even though you're producing the color, all colors are ultimately God's, right, God's creation. I could try to do it that way, but I don't think it would be wise.
But the idea is that this person has a knack for arranging colors.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that this person used to arrange colors and then started learning Gemara and then was...
It's about Shiva, that's a new solution. It wasn't in the bathroom, it was in his dark days, in a garret in Paris.
I mean, if you want to conclude something about the writer from this, you can't then conclude that the writer thinks that that's a value.
I think the writer wrote it for an audience that could appreciate it. Right, that this sugya is written for people. Right, for whom, oh, I understand what it means like to experience beauty that way. Right, that's there. I think the sugya is written for people who can stare at Rothko's. I wish now happily I can count myself, sort of. I have to say, still thinking about that one, much to my surprise. I may yet be an abstract person. Andre on Rothko, who knows? Maybe I'll go back to Jasper John's White on White. I think Jasper John's the one who did White on White. So white canvas painted white. One color. Yes.
I mean, even if you take that, I mean, I don't see why it would be, why you think unlikely that the point here is that it's divine, meaning that it's not man-made beauty. I think that's not the point, right? Meaning, in the end, what's producing the beauty, right? You're creating the Atimta, but the beauty is created through the sun, right? Meaning, the whole point of revealing on the beauty is that it's on that, right? That it's, right? It's the beauty of Yerushalayim, presumably, right? That beauty, right? It represents something more than physical. Right, the reason the people of Yerushalayim were so beautiful is because, right, there's something, right, ethereal about it.
That's fine. If you want to end up with, you know, this is a manifesto, right? You want to write a particular credo as to what kind of art is worth producing. The kind of art is worth producing is one that shows that the beauty of earthly objects is really divine, and the way it does that is by showing that beauty is ultimately not a function of the form that human beings give, but rather of light. That, I think, is a cool manifesto for Jewish religious art. I'm okay with it. I rather like it.
What?
I rather like it.
I'm
open to you. If you want to claim that it's about a specific, that's just one version of it. If you want to claim it's making a specific claim about the kinds of beauty and the kinds of message that beauty should convey, that's okay with me. I just think it's hard to claim it's irrelevant, or altifnu el elilim.
Again, as we pointed out, right, denying the value of art does not, in order to divide it, deny the value of art, you do not have to deny the value of beauty. That is not the point of the Ritva. Right, the point of the Ritva is not to deny the value of visual, to deny the value of
the artificial visual.
Yeah.
But this is at least a partially artificial visual. It doesn't happen by itself. Unless you take the cup and the pomegranate seeds and the roses there, All you have is Vayavdel Elokim bin Orav v'Nechoshech. It takes a human being to arrange these things, not to mention to produce the cup, to create that beauty. So I think you can create a very cool artistic manifesto as to how it works, but I don't think you can claim that it's just about appreciate the Scottish Highlands. All right, that's wrong. There's more than Scottish Highlands going on here. Not that I myself have ever seen the Scottish Highlands. Unless you can see them from a plane, I doubt that's the way you're supposed to appreciate them from overhead. Okay, good. So moving back to the straightforwardly halachic, so we gave you a Gemara and Brachos, and the Parali Yerushalmi, all of which seem to suggest that there are occasions on which one should in fact appreciate the beauty of objects, and in fact there is a halachic obligation to...
Why don't you say a bracha?
How do you say the bracha if you don't appreciate it? I don't know, what position is that? You want to tell me that this is a bidyevet bracha, right? This is the parallel of Rabbi Akiva's bracha upon encountering a beautiful woman at a crossroad. Right? Of course I shouldn't have gotten hanoah from him. Now that I've gotten hanoah from him, I should at least make a bracha. Okay. These are all accidental brachot. I was walking around one corner and I read it, right, and a fig tree was coming the other way. I never saw it coming. Well, smacked right into the fig tree. So I said, Baruch. I walked into the middle of a food fight and I got hit in the head by a loaf of bread. Okay, that's how it happened. Or I'm out fixing the Arab, right, and all of a sudden, right, and okay, when it turns out there's a bakery next door, and I'm struck by the shape of the loaf. Okay,
it is interesting, though, that the Gemara has, in the discussion on the bracha,
uh-huh.
But in the case, it doesn't say,
a pas na'a.
I mean, we could say
it's that significant. Well, apa, the Gemara coming
out,
we could say it's subjective.
Well, you see apa, and you say the bracha, even if you don't think it's nice.
Well, Ra'a Pat V'Amar, Kamana Epatzu, Baruch HaMakom Shebarah. I don't think this is a Beis Hillel position, that whenever you see a piece of bread, you're obligated to say, I really do, I mean, I have much more time to cheer today. I think I haven't been funny enough all year, but it's forever a Ramadur now. I actually have in my house, but I have a little framed picture from a fellow named Harry Daniels who draws pictures of Shtetl. And the picture is a woman with holding a big braided loaf of bread over her head, and the caption is Kala Mitachala. Kala Mitachala. He claimed there was a minhag in Poland that the Kala would dance with a Kala. And it's a Kala with a Kala. Maybe that's the fish tail. People would think Bat Noeva Chassida. I can't tell you for sure. Very good picture.
When you say Kala now, the Chassida, it's not that you're supposed to appreciate the beauty of the Kala.
Yes, it does.
Considering
half an hour later, half an hour later, there's some machlokas in the Gemara whether you should daf a stare at the Kala to appreciate her beauty or whether that's usher. And that is the context of the Gemara.
Yes, the Beis Chavetz is, as I say, you know, maybe we just pass him like Beis Chavetz and we look at, you know, and...
Or maybe we could try it, figure out a different way and maybe we'd be happy that she's getting married?
Yeah, let's not get stuck on the Kala. We're talking about the Kala now. Now we know the Kala's had feelings, right?
Yeah. They definitely
All right. Any case, the point of all this is that, all right, and then I just gave you for fun the Rashi and Zachariah, who seems to have an appreciation, you know, who seems to believe that it is a worthwhile aspect of human nature to praise particular kinds of architecture. But all this is just the build-up to the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which seems to suggest that mana ilan zeh, right, is not a good thing you want to do. It's something that causes you to be minchayev benafsho. So the question is, how does one reconcile a series of statements which seem to acknowledge the appreciation of beauty as something of religious worth with a statement which on the surface seems to suggest that even the appreciation of divinely ordained beauty, right, it has both of them, right? It has an ilan, which is a natural phenomenon, and a nir, which is an artificial phenomenon. Right, so how do you square any claim that these things are valueless with a Mishnah which... how do you square this Mishnah, which seems to suggest that any appreciation of visual stimuli is a negative, with these statements that have brachos for them? So there's a simplest way, again, which is to say that it's just b'dievid.
Or in the bathroom.
Can't make the bracha, but it doesn't have shem malchus, who knows?
Wait, what one's
b'dievid? So as you're leaving. Yeah, there's the equivalent of a Karen's obvious. Right, that's right.
Wait, what?
Maybe you're not supposed to really see a beautiful piece of bread, right? You really should eat without looking at it while you're learning.
Well, I mean,
but
the beautiful woman really is carrying this kind of
body. Yes, that's what I'm saying. So, I'm not, right, so we can invent this. We can just say all beauty.
Just only while you're learning.
Okay, we'll talk about maybe it's only while you're learning, right? Let's hold off on that.
But why is the other one simpler than it's while you're learning?
Because I don't want to get to while you're learning yet, because it'll destroy the order of the share. As Rav Amitel said, Josh Berman said to Rav Amitel years ago, I just love this. When Josh Berman gave this wonderful Dvar Torah at a Goshal Shittus, which was built around, there's no pasuk in which Yitzchak and Yishmael appear together. And somewhere in the middle of the Dvar Torah, Rav Amitel took out a Tanakh and pointed out that Yitzchak Yitzchak Yishmael Benav, and said, Matzati pasuk! And Josh looked at him and said, Arav Mikal Kelo Tavort! Because that was supposed to be the climactic moment, as it was a beautiful Tartara. Came out and, you know, and just killed it by throwing it out of it. That was my only experience around Mital in person. I just loved watching it. It was such a beautiful interaction. Sati Pasuk. I missed the Pasuk the first time I gave a Tartara in front of Lichtenstein. But he was nice enough not to point it out to me. wasn't the setup, I just missed the Pasuk. But, yeah. And Mrs. Lichtenstein told me that it was a good Vartor anyway. Because I went over to apologize afterwards. I missed the puzzle. all right. Chir Zerua, has an interesting extension of this. He says, Zichroni, Geshoni ha-mechaber nar katan, v'ayu mitzayrin b'mayshin v'veit knesset ofod bilanot, v'danti sh'asur la'asot kein v'mashe shanini mastik mishnato v'amir mana'ilam zeh, Alma shemachmach notain li bolilan yafe, eno mechaven li vishnato mafsik, Kol shekein tefilah shetzricha kavanat tvei sheni yachol lechavein karoish kishra mistakel b'ilanot ha-metzirot b'kotel. So this is an interesting thing, and it stands in an interesting contrast to the picture Yedidia sent around of what a dominant what a dominant room might look like. So he extends it from ilanot to pictures of ilanot, and he extends it from learning to davening.
Extended
culture. Culture came, right? So beauty distracts you from the things that matter.
But then we have, you know, then we just have a version of the general Theravada question.
Yeah, anything distracts you from the things that matter, as long as it's not a thing that matters. Mm-hmm. Right? So just have anything but the things that matter may distract you from the things that matter. So the question, right? So the question is looking at pictures of trees something that matters or not?
But no, I mean, if you're...
Yes?
Which one?
Adina, go ahead.
But he's on
the
house in
Shulon
for davening.
Right, so it might be it's just talking about learning and davening. The question is, when should you be doing other things? I mean, what is there to do other than davening and learning?
Well, if you don't sleep at some point, you might die.
So you're sleeping, right? You can contemplate, right? You can contemplate beautiful images during sleep. Maybe. Or Zman She'ein Lo Yom. Yeah, Zman She'ein Lo Yom Lo Laila. Right, when you're learning Chachmat Yevanit. You can do this too. Yes, Miriam?
I was just going to say that let's say you're learning one thing and then someone else is learning something else and you overhear it. So, I mean...
Even important things can distract you from important things.
And certain things are not important, but they don't distract you because you find them irrelevant.
Uh-huh.
So whether or not it's inherently important is not related to whether or not it's distracting.
Okay, let's hold that for a moment also. Rabbi Yonah says, right, Ki be'od she'adam shoneh ein lo lehasiach sichat chulin, ki tzarich lamod bira ve'mal lefnei ha-Torah, right, me'achar she'nishtamesh be'kitra shel Torah, tzarich le'daber sicha b'teila, ve'im kal roshol lehasik mishnato, ha'reza mitchayev b'nafsho. So Rabbi Yonah gives with one hand and takes over the other. On the one hand, he seems to imply that the whole point is that it's a lack of kvod ha-Torah. But if you never started learning, then it's not such a bad thing. On the other hand, he tells you explicitly, this is valueless, right? This is sicha b'teila. Mana ilanze. Okay, so there's a heter for it, but it's the heter of, watching inane cartoons in order to refresh yourself so you can learn Torah again. Okay, assuming inane kosher cartoons. Okay. The Barzanura, however, goes along and says, what do you call sicha b'teila, right? So it's explicit, right? Well, this is sicha b'teila. But then he says, v'yesho mrim da'ashmin ravusa, di'afal gab dal yidei kain, right, who mevarech baruch shekachalo b'alamo, afal pi kain malin alav kilu mitchayev b'nafshov, neshev sik mishnato. So this is a different position. The second position seems to claim that this is a value, it's just important that this value not interrupt your Torah. Right? Because here he explicitly relates to our Makara. And he says, look, there is a religious purpose to beauty. Right?
I really strongly into the first position than the second.
Yeah?
Meaning, once you have the second one, right, it's assuming, right, what's it assuming? That the reason, right, if he already has a category of looking at a tree which will not be sicha b'teila.
Yeah.
Right? The way I read it is that by implication you could read the first half as saying, right, it could have been, right, if he's just saying mana ilan zeh and not talking about it the way I'm talking in my second yeshomrim, right, so, right, that's a problem like any other sicha b'teila.
Right.
So this one, the first day would actually assume that if he stopped to appreciate it as God's work, then that would be mutter.
The first edition says
right, I mean,
that it's only because it's sicha b'teila.
Right, exactly. I mean, the second one is saying, even if he stops to appreciate God, but the first one is saying, had he stopped to appreciate God, that would have been fine.
Interesting. Okay, so you have two positions. The first one calls it sicha b'teila.
No, he doesn't. It's hu adin.
L'chol sicha b'teila.
Right, and therefore it's only the manai which is sicha b'teila. Right, because what the second line tells you is that there are categories which are not sicha b'teila, and it's still usur, which means the first one is saying, right, maybe saying, only the type of saying, mana ilan zeh, that would be considered sicha b'teila, would you not be allowed to be masik for?
I think what the idea of the chol sichabatel is really the chol shars. And you think if he said, because he only said mana ilan, he didn't say baruch shekach alo ba'olamo?
Yeah.
Doesn't convince me, but you're welcome to have it. Doesn't convince me. I think that the, at least the way I read it is that the first thing assumes that it's sicha betela, and the second one, see now the question, which gets what Jonathan's pointing out, is what is the connection between the speech and the experience? Is it, he looks at the tree, he says, how beautiful a tree. You say, who adin l'chol sicha betela? We should be sharper. And this may change your reading. Who adin l'chol sicha betela means you shouldn't have said it. But it doesn't necessarily tell you shouldn't have looked at it. It's just you shouldn't have said it. And Jonathan's saying, well, you know what? And even if you said it, as long as you followed it up by the right by Baruch Shekach Alo Ba'olamo, there's nothing wrong with saying it either. Right, you have to make it. You have to makdish the thing. So I can't dismiss that out of hand. I still tend to think that the most likely reading is that the first position assumes it's sicha betela, and the second position says that no, appreciation of natural beauty leads you to mitzvot. It doesn't say it is a mitzvah; it says it leads you to mitzvot. There's a more radical reading of the second position, which is
the second position still assumes it's aser.
Yeah, it's still aser while you're learning.
Right.
But it's valuable when you're not learning. It acknowledges that there's nothing wrong with saying mana ilan zeh per se. What's wrong is saying mana ilan zeh in the middle of your learning.
So
but it's not sicha betela
the
rest of the time.
So would the first version think that in a vacuum, saying right, looking at a tree and saying, right, Baruch Shekach Alo Ba'olamo is Sicha B'Teila. Right, that's right. The implication, right, if you read it, right, my problem with reading it the way you read it is that, right, is once you read the second Yesh Omrim, you know that he has in the back of his mind a category which is valuable enough of, that you can make a bracha.
So I tend to think that the first position holds that this is B'Dievet. Right, if you appreciate natural beauty, the way to redeem your experience is to say Baruch Shekach Alo Ba'olamo. But the second, the most radical way of reading the second position is that it's not saying the bracha which matters. It's since this experience can lead you, right, is recognized, right, by the possibility of saying Baruch Shekach Alo Ba'olamo, therefore it is valuable, right? It's not because Afal Pish She'amar Achar Kach Baruch Shekach Alo Ba'olamo, it's Afal Pish Alidei Kach Hu Ba'olamar. Right? If this experience is recognized as valuable by the system. And even though we generally recognize that, we generally say the appreciation of beauty is a value, right, such that we even impose upon you the obligation to recognize it religiously, nonetheless, I think that's the most radical way of reading the second position. You can find a way of reading, reading it into the first as well. But it still clearly thinks that this is something you engage in. It's the same issue. It's the question of if you have to choose the activities you engage in when you're not learning Torah. So this is the activity to engage. This is one of the plausible activities to engage in. Right, how it stacks up against Bikur Cholim, I don't know. Right, but once you're doing Bikur Cholim, you might as well say, "Ooh, that's a nice painting you have in your room, Mrs. Johnson." Or what pretty flowers you have, Mrs. Johnson. It might be that's all it is. Okay, Rav Matisya Hayitare, whom we have recently discovered because he made it out to Bar Ilan. We will soon have in Shulchan Aruch Yeridea, I think Rav Miller told us, that there are some blank spots on certain pages in the standard Shulchan Aruch where it's clear that something used to be, and that's because somebody who sponsored an edition that's a precursor of our current edition paid the printer to put his own commentaries in there, and then later people, when didn't think they were worthwhile, so he didn't pay for it, so they just copied it over. So soon we're going to have bribery scandals of people getting onto Bar Ilan, because that's the way to spread your Torah. If I could get our journal onto Bar Ilan, that would be really worth it. Okay, Rabbi.
Do they have any journals on Bar Ilan yet?
Pardon?
Do they have any journals on Bar Ilan yet?
They only have references, not the journals themselves. They have an index of Kitvei 8, but they don't actually have the Kitvei 8, so far as I know. So, Rav Matisya Yitzhari says
ואין ספק כי להיות הנפש אחת, אם ישתדל להשתמש בחושיו בעניינים החמרים שאינם מעניין עיונו, יסבלבלו כוחותיו הפנימיים ויסבלבל שכלו, ולא יראה שכלו למיטת הדברים לעומקו, ויתחלס לו העצם למקרה, והפכו, right? And so the essential will be confused with the accidental, right? That's a technical conversation. And in reverse, ואמת בשקר, והפכו. Okay. You can't, right? He says, since you only have one nefesh, if you focus on the external, you can't focus on the internal. Right? So, right? Don't look and think. Yes, don't look and think at the same time. The Rashbat comes along.
Of course, you could also read him the saying, right? You know, if you were looking at something that would be meaning not be, you know.
Then it would work. Right? You can look at the page.
Right? So if you're like, no, or if you're learning Raka,
maybe that would work.
And you, right? His point is, right? Is, I don't know if he's making a, right? Is he making a claim that you can't think and appreciate the visual, or you can't think about one thing and appreciate a visual that's not related at the same time?
Maybe.
It's simply a question of focus, right? Meaning, right, you're saying you can't use, right, your senses to focus on something different than your intellect at the same time, right, because you have to be focused.
But he likes mnemonics. If you can focus things actually create, like the current, right, the current, one of the current mnemonic tricks is, right, is you should map the stuff you're learning onto the world around you visually. So that would be great. Okay. Very possible. Very possible.
But also like it's a philosophical thing, right? By concentrating on the stuff that, right, the homari stuff around you, right, you're being with all your sehel and not concentrating on the abstraction.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's what he's saying.
Okay, I'm going to bracket it. I got to move, right? I'm building towards one vort, sorry, right? So, okay, so the Magen Avot of the Rashbat says it's a question of Chilul Kvod HaTorah, so again, it's a question of context. The Nerkev with the Mishnah of Al-Shakar says it's also a hefsek in your learning, right, because you're Shopasek, now Shom Me'etz HaChaim, which of course is Torah. And he goes so far as Alafilo Yisaseg B'davar Shiyesh Bo Ksat Mitzvah. So he's explicit, right? That this is a, right, that we actually do give value to be royally noted. He even calls it Ksas Mitzvah. Okay, the Pirkei Moshe has the Rashbat.
No,
Pirkei Moshe. Pirkei Moshe. Ah, about if I know only Rav Moshe Almoshnino.
Really? My Latin teacher in high school
was
named Almoshnino.
And that's about.
Born circa 1580.
Yeah. Hey, apparently he wrote a commentary on a philosophic commentary on Pirkei Avot, which made it into Bar Ilan. That's about all I can tell you. Okay, so he has a long philosophic thing, right? He says is that what goes on here is Shomer Manel in Ze, Lo Amar Maneh Ha'ilan, right? So he thinks the flaw is that you are appreciating particular beauty.
Not trinus.
Right? Mana ilan zeh. But if you could look at it, right, if you could look at a tree and say, right, and appreciate trinus, that would be beautiful. So the word I'm building towards is that the Rambam in all you notice in the last set of commentaries is there's this constant reference to Bereishis. Posek nafsho, right? Posek nafsho meitz chayim, right? And people are putting in philosophic terms on the relationship between the senses, the senses and the intellect. And what I want to suggest is that all these are branches of a single tree. To some degree. They're all branches of the only tree that was at the center of Eden, which is a different shear. But there's only one tree at the center of Eden. But what I want to suggest is there's a seminal Rambam. Right?
You mean that like the it's the dot,
yeah,
and
the same tree.
Yes,
Ha'i Yitzhashem. Yes, they both have to be Torah, right? How else do you know good and evil? Yeah. Any case, but leaving aside that part, what I want to suggest is solve. The Rambam in guide 1-2 tells you that the fall of Adam Rishon is opposed to the chait. Right? The problem everyone has to deal with is how could there be a chait if Adam Rishon was perfect? How could he sin? This is solved in various ways. The Ramban comes up with the external yitzhara, which is the snake.
Problem is, Ramban thinks that in Yosef Mashiach, the Yetzirah goes back into the snake, but why doesn't the snake tempt us again? Never explained. Right? So even the Ramban doesn't have a good explanation of how we ever become eternally good. But the Rambam's solution, if you read him closely, is that the chet was not the same thing as the fall. Right? The fall of man comes when you notice the tree. Vatera isha kitavat, right? Kitavai samachal v'chi right, so the fall is when Chava notices that there is such a thing as visual desire. The chet is a natural consequence of that. Once you have visual desire, which the Rambam claims is the abandonment of interest in the abstract for interest in the particular. That's what Turkey Moshe is saying. Right, that's when the fall is. So I want to suggest. First of all, it struck me a couple of years ago that it was really that the Rambam Perek Aleph. This is, I think, maybe a key to reading sections of the Mora Bichlal, that the right Perek Aleph Alchabed of the Mora is actually a commentary on this Mishnah. Right, the Rambam read the Chazal saying Mana Eil Ilan Zeh Mana En Yir Zeh. The Rambam read that as a medrash on the creation story, and that may also explain. Why am I not in years there? Because right? I was like, whoever says what a beautiful furrow? Right? My alien said that's beautiful, but what does that mean? But if you remember that in Bereshis, right, the curse is agriculture. Right, the curse, right? So then you understand that we're talking about that the Rambam read this as the Rambam thinks that Adam HaRishon thought only about Torah and was distracted from Torah by the tree. So one is Mafsik in Mishnah To and says either A, how beautiful this tree is, meaning he recreates the chet, or Mana En Yirze, meaning I am happier being Adam HaRishon after the chet than before. Actually, recreates the fall, right? Or says I'm happier being Adam HaRishon after the fall than before.
Did you say this explicitly at any point, or is no? This is your read. Okay.
This is my I read the Pirkei Moshe, and I said that's a cool read, Mana E Ilan Zeh, this tree as opposed to all trees. And I read the other commentaries which said, and I said maybe that's what's going on in the Rambam, right? The Rambam reads this Mishnah as philosophic, and maybe that's how the Rambam. And I think this may be a key understanding how the Rambam believed that Chazal were philosophers, because if right, this was his generous reading, right? What are they talking about? Trees, furrows, right? They must be, right? If they're talking about stopping. They're talking about stopping Torah, right? For appreciating the beauty of trees. Well, I know where that comes from. Yes, he did. Yeah.
So if Torah is like the right abstract, perfect, and complete right contemplation of the good,
mm-hmm.
right? Then does that mean that if we right strive to really be, if we really strive to be B'nai Torah and we really eventually grasp that, we will not need clothes anymore? And we will have no concept of shame.
So I think that the Rambam does not believe you can escape embodiment. We have bodies, so I don't think the Rambam thinks you can transcend that. Right? It's an ideal, right? You could be an angel. If you're an angel, you only think about this. But the Rambam doesn't read the story of Reshit Bet as sequential. First human beings were like this and then they were like that. He reads it as a metaphor. Human beings could have been like this, but God put us into bodies where we cannot avoid having sense desires. Right? So I don't think that he sees it as the ambition to go back to taking off clothes. I argue Shabbos, right? I think that Noah thought you could. Right? That's what I think Noah did when he got drunk. Was he tried to be Adam HaRishon Kol Machet. But I think the Rambam would tell you that was a historical error. Human beings, right, it's not possible to be Adam HaRishon, Kodem HaChet, because there is no Adam HaRishon Kodem HaChet. Adam HaRishon Kodem HaChet, right, Adam HaRishon Kodem HaNefilah, so to speak, right, is a hypothetical, never happened. Because right, he wouldn't be human. And if he didn't, there's your sense that, yes, in theory, you could construct a society of all philosophers that sit around naked, but they have to eat. Right, God gave us appetites. Right, I don't think they're on...
Well,
Well, the Rambam thinks we are, but we're, but you know, but our condition is fallenness, right? That we don't. The Rambam doesn't believe that fallenness is escapable. Right? That would be.
And that's why even philosophy dictates to us that we must wear clothes, even though if you were a true student for philosophy, perfectly we wouldn't need.
We understand that clothes are only necessary because we live in human society. Right? I don't know that Rambam thinks that there's any need to wear clothes. When wear clothes if you're in the desert, there's no other human beings around, and that may be the message that he learns from Rav Shimon bar Yochai in the cave. Right? When they take their clothes off so they won't wear out.
But they sit up there next to the sand.
Yes.
They're covered.
Look. And they take them. When do they put their clothes on again?
When they daven.
Very odd. it's very.
Exactly. You shouldn't need the clothes when you're davening.
Very odd.
When you daven, you need to stand up and stuff.
Maybe you can't bow down when you're buried up to your neck in sand. It's true. I don't think that literally. I think that there's a point to his claiming that they have to live all the time without clothes. But the story won't work if they're naked, because we're trying to tell a story that people are like, and people, if we tell you the story that they're naked, then we turn out to be chum. Right, so the story they can't be naked. In the story they're not visible. They just take off their clothes. But I think they're malachim in the cave. I think that's how he reads it. Yes, Miriam, do you have a question? No. Okay, so this is right. So now the question that then raises: if I'm right that's what the Rama means, but also right that you can't overcome it. So the question is then: so for the Rambam, the appreciation of any visual beauty is a distraction. But there are many things in this world that we do now that are valuable, which shouldn't be, according to the Rambam. Ethics, according to at least some shita in the Rambam, shouldn't be necessary or valuable. But now that we have them, now that we live in a world where ethics is necessary, so they have value. Maybe beauty is the same way. Right, there's always the question of how we... Right, the Rambam tells you that in an unfallen world, the only thing that would matter would be conceptual truth. But we live in a fallen world, so I don't know that the Rambam necessarily does that. Three things to finish off this unit, then we'll move on to Levin Al-Harot. I've quoted all the shitas, but it seems to me that there's a much simpler way out of this Mishnah, which is we're talking about Mishnah. Right? Mishnah, right? What do I mean by Mishnah? Mishnah is when you're repeating Torah Shebal Peh Be'al Peh. So you can't, right? And so we're talking about the entire preservation of the Masoret depends on the accuracy of your, right, of your calling things accurate. I'm talking about looking at things while you're thinking. Dafka, right? It's not. It'll confuse you while you're thinking. We're talking about memorization, right? This is not to, right, to be shown at your Mishnah was to repeat everything you knew by heart. If you allow distraction to enter into that, then the whole system collapses. And it's right. So I tend to think this is a much narrower Mishnah. It's actually specifically about the importance of maintaining the memorized stuff accurately. Because it's irresponsible, because everybody depends on you. Right, that's my much narrower way of escaping this. It's actually not about aesthetics whatsoever. It's about not allowing anything to distract you while you're preserving the Masoret. Yes.
So this, you know, maybe this is like getting off into like totally territory we don't want to get into. But it did sort of come up that like while we were sort of passing our covers up, right when. Plato enters into, right, basically the discourse of like all these philosophical rishonim, right?
Yeah.
What force does that take on once it's like in the Masoret, right? And the fact that like Plato is being read, right, this mission is being read as Plato,
yeah,
by so many, right? Even if you know you actually go back and say, oh well, you know what, actually, like, the mission probably was really just talking about the importance of concentrating when you're memorizing something,
yeah,
which seems totally plausible to me, right? So the question is, so well, what status then do we give Plato as part of the Masoret?
So there are three types of questions in there. One is, do we care about the original intent of the Mishnah, or do we just say the Mishnah means what the Rambam said it meant? So there I do not agree with Rabbi Jechter. I think if you don't think that's pshat in the Mishnah, then it doesn't have the authority of the Mishnah. It has the authority of the Rishonim who quote it. And there's a second question, which is, what if the Rishonim are following somebody else, does that diminish its authority? And on moral issues, I don't think so. Of course, they're influenced by other people. If the Rishonim found this valuable, and they believed it, so that we understand them to be influenced by another source, I don't see why that should diminish its authority in that sense. Then there's a third question, is it's Plato. Maybe that increases its authority. But the underlying, what I want to mean by that is that not is that the chakiras in Plato and Socrates, as Whitehead said, are the fundamental chakiras of philosophy. It's not because Plato said them. They're the issues that all thinking people have to think about. All right? And you have to come down on one side or the other. So whether you're a Platonist or an Aristotelian about the precedence of forms as opposed to particulars, you're not following Plato You're not following Plato. You have to take a position about that. It happens that Plato took a position about that. It's very likely that Plato brings one to awareness of that position. But many, many people have arrived at that position without knowing anything about Plato. So I don't think this particular issue... I think if you're sensitive to philosophic issues, you will notice this. Now, you might think that philosophy is irrelevant. Right? You might have the same kind of critique of philosophy that I sometimes have of Brisk, that it deals with abstractions that aren't really what the stuff of the real world is about. But this particular thing, I don't have any difficulty with it. I don't think it's chat in this Mishnah only because of post-Sekhem Mishnah To. Right? If the Mishnah said Kol HaMahalech B'Derech Omer Manalein Zed Mifchai V'Nafsho, or Kol HaLomei Torah, I would have no trouble believing that the Mishnah had the exact same position. All right, that's the way I would frame that. Okay, two other things. Rav Lichtenstein says somewhere, and Jonathan reports it as Torah Shebal Peh, but I don't believe I heard this from him, Torah Shebal Peh, and Jonathan also thinks it's written down somewhere. So I think it's written down somewhere. Rav Lichtenstein suggests that in a response to a claim, to a hypothetical claim that this Mishnah undermines the entire Torah Mada enterprise, that the correct way to read this is that anybody who sees Mana'e Ilan Zeh as a Hesek in the Mishnah is Mishchayev B'Nafsho, because how can you believe... It might be. I thought about that, but I couldn't. I had that in my office. It might have an index, but I had that in my office.
But it's impossible to find anything in that article.
I don't know if it has an index. I don't think that's where it is, but it could be. But his claim is that, this is the way Jonathan tried to read the first position of the Barzun earlier, that anybody who considers being Mafsik Mishnah Tel Mana'e Ilan Zeh, right, is Mishchai V'Nafsho, because how can you see appreciation of the world as a break in your Mishnah? Of course it's all Torah. Right, this is usually like my example of what great modern Orthodox drush is. Right, this is great modern Orthodox drush. It seems to be really, really unlikely that it's shot in the Mishnah, but it's such great drush. Right, this is what we need. We need a community that is capable of saying, because one of the beauties of drush, I'll say, as opposed to midrash.
What's the difference between drush and shot?
Drush is eisegesis. Drush is a way of making a text mean something which it doesn't actually mean. It's using a text as a mnemonic for your idea.
That's not the same thing as Midrash.
No. Actually, it's very different from Midrash. Midrash is about the text. Drush is about the idea in the text. But one of the great one of the great things about Drush, which Chazal got, is that Drush is a tremendous mnemonic. Right? You will remember an idea in a text because it seems incongruous. Right? Whether or not it's what the text actually means, you'll never forget it. Like, so for me, that idea is embodied in that text. Whenever I think of this text, I will always think of this other interpretation. Whether or not I find it plausible, right? That's what great drush is. Great drush is the way that it actually sticks it into a verse so implausibly that you can never think of the verse and think, wow, I remember that wild interpretation.
So how do you say that's
true? I don't think it's true as Chat in the Mishnah. I think it's a beautiful mnemonic for Rav Lichtenstein's philosophy. I don't think the Mishnah contradicts it either, because I think the Chat in the Mishnah is irrelevant to this. Right? But you have to build a culture. You build a culture around mnemonics. Right, often around ideas that don't really mean what the terms used them for. Chadash.
Or they mean the opposite. Yeah. They seem to mean the opposite.
Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Right. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah is a halachic category. It doesn't mean the new is forbidden. And it was a chiddush to say the Chadash Asur Min HaTorah means that. Right. But it's great. Your Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, that stands for the broad principle that the new is forbidden. I did a thing this year on Kol Kvudo Bas Melech Pnima, which has nothing whatsoever to do with Tznius. It means many things, but it doesn't mean Tznius. So for beauty, I haven't mentioned the entire summer. Again, Yaftel Lekim Liyefet. Right, try and find any reference in the tradition to Yaftel Lekim Liyefet, meaning that we should bring Greek art into Right? I think Rav Hirsch is the first place you'll find it. And then it but it's a really great mnemonic for that notion that we have to bring beauty into Torah. You know, sometimes, right, you know, suppose you don't think Tzelem Elokim really means the image of God. Right? Most of the Rishonim don't. Right? Tzelem Elokim means the mold in which God produces things. Right? Not the image of God. To the point that you have Rishonim read it, Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo, b'tzelem, Elokim bara oto. There is not even such... Angels. In the Tzelem Dmut that we own. Look, we have a machine here. It stamps out human beings. That's our Tzelem. That's our Dmut. By the whole phrase Tzelem Elokim, some Rishon, right? Rashi, I think, right, reads it against the Trap as Tzelem Elokim Barauto. So okay, there I have to think the Pshat is with us. I like it, but if it weren't, it'd still be a great mnemonic. Dina Malchut Adina, right, which we use to tell people they have to obey the law, but which probably doesn't mean that at all. Now you should obey the law, and human beings really are created in the image of God. And right, and seeing this as a value, it just happens that those phrases are not the ones that really are the source of them. But they're really good, right? And it's a really interesting question when you teach children, whether you shouldn't write. I tend to think that probably one of the most important things, we may talk about tomorrow night, in terms of educating children, is that they should have short, easily rememberable traditional phrases that stand for really broad principles. Whether or not those are the original meanings of the phrase. I think that every kid should know Rav Lichtenstein's parish on right on that mission of us. Because that's what it should mean in modern orthodoxy. Right? Everyone should have in their heads, right, you know, that whenever I look at a tree, I have to think this is Talmud Torah.
And like Torah
Darah. Yeah, Torah Darah is a nice phrase which probably didn't mean right, probably originally it didn't mean anything about German culture in the 19th century, astonishingly enough. Could have been, yeah. Not want to rule out Ruach HaKodesh, but it's possible that it has very, very little to do with German culture in the 19th century. Okay.
Freedom
is slavery. Ignorance is bliss. I forget what the others are. I think you have to make clear the distinction between drush and pshat. That I think the pshat drush distinction is very valuable. It's the pshat medrush distinction that isn't. But at what age we introduce the pshat drush distinction and tell you that this phrase, which culturally means this, but in its original historical context doesn't actually mean that, that's a very interesting educational question. Right.
Really after 8th grade, because I think the Chadash HaSim Yosher was part of the Camp Dora Golding education after 8th grade, and they just made no mention of that.
Okay, the last thing I was going to mention, which I have not read more than the brief excerpt, Sinti Ozix, the pagan rabbi, appears to be under extremely good copy protection, such that you can't find anywhere on the web the actual text of the story. That I can find it, but the fun of the pagan rabbi just always worthwhile. The pagan rabbi is a character who is found strangled, hanging by his talus from a tree, having committed suicide. But apparently, you find out in the story that the reason he did is that he was a Talmud Chacham who was seduced by the tree nymph. By the tree nymph.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's really cool.
the female goddess of the tree. So it's all written as a parish on this Mishnah. Right, the whole story is a parish on this Mishnah. It's her attempt to explain how, right, so her pshat basically is that appreciation of nature is paganism. Right, it's a return to pantheism.
Did a tree nymph kill him? Or
no, he committed suicide because he couldn't deal.
Did he commit suicide with the tree?
Yes. Got to read the whole story. But I thought that you can see how a contemporary artist, right, a contemporary artist could really understand, right, how it is that appreciation of beauty is, right, leads to Avodah Zarah. Right, because that's what the story is about. Just a little bit more sympathetic to the Avodah Zarah than you might otherwise. Well, the synthetic is very from sympathetic, often, right? So the stories are often about the tension, right? So I read the story a long, long time ago. I suspect you read it, you would get a nice, understanding of the tension and how an artist reads, assuming that this Mishnah is read as, again, culturally, in most of the culture, Mana Ilan Zeh is read as an anti-art statement, right? And that's certainly how she experienced it, right? So the pagan rabbi is her response as an artist to this Mishnah from the perspective of somebody who gets it, right? Who understands why you might critique, why you might think that art is avodah zarah. You might. It's a risk. It's always a risk. Okay. So much for Mana Ilan Zeh. So the next thing, which we'll have to do really, really rapidly, but we're on, is to figure out what we do with the Heter Mufavina Lahorot. Now, this Heter has been, hopefully is what, is those of you who have guilt pangs. Right? I try not to force people to do things that are actually elsewhere in the context of the program. So hopefully Mufavina Lahorot, is a Heter for any, in case you thought you weren't allowed in the MFA or not. But what does Lahavina Lahorot really mean? So we have a bunch of segiot which tell you that Lahavina Lahorot is something that's really pretty wild. Lahavina Lahorot allows you to do things that, done for other motives, would make you chayiv misa, lose your chelek in olam haba, all sorts of pretty serious things, avodah zarah and minus. And it's not just, in Lahavina Lahorot, it's not just that you can do intellectual things. You can actually do practical. You can engage in witchcraft, loving lahoros. Right? You can magically make almond trees. What are cucumbers? Cucumbers, right? You can actually make cucumbers appear and disappear. Now, what that means, I haven't the faintest idea. But apparently,
you can summon
them. Pardon? You can summon them. I feel. I know. Rashi says, "Shahita kan tadek hosem masa, shahita kan tadek yushuin velikta mamish bikshafim." Right? But this is mutter, loving lahoros. So you can do Lavin Lahorot seems a pretty good heter for pretty much everything you want. That's the bottom line. Except saying God's name, but then even then, right? It's a heter as long as you don't do it excessively, right? It has to be not gratuitous. It has to be spiritually enriching. Perhaps or something like that. I don't know, right? It's a pretty wild heter. Now Rashi seems not to have that girsa, as the Tosafos points out, and Rashi says that, well, you know what, there's some things you shouldn't do. There's some things maybe you shouldn't do kichut hasara, that's Tosafos' position. I'm not so sure Tosafos is right. Maybe Rashi had that girsa and said even before Hesia, so he did it loving Lahoros, how can he be chayev? And the answer is that he can do it kichut hasara. Right, so I don't see any reason to believe that Rashi doesn't.
What would
all the people be doing with Tosafos? Would be Hoget Hashem B'Otiyot? No, all the witches do it.
Well,
I don't know, right? Maybe everyone can do things loving the Lahorot, right? Maybe you just wanted to research a paper in high school on Zeus. In order to research that paper, there are all sorts of things you have to do, right? So you want to know, you want to know really why was it us, or what was so powerful about bowing down to Zeus? So you go and you bow down to Zeus. Just because loving the Lahorot, right? You want to know what it was, why would, because it seems so silly. Why do people bow down to idols? Why was it powerful? Right? Or
they all ask themselves that
why do people stop being shum by reading Bertrand Russell? I really need to know, because I need to talk to people who stop being shum.
By reading
Bertrand Russell? Yes. Because they pick up why I'm not a Christian, thinking it's an anti-missionary text, like me. But it turns out to be an attack on religion b'chol. But Reverend Soloveitchik picked up Wellhausen and got introduced to biblical criticism because it was in Hebrew, and he didn't know that it was clear written in Hebrew. So here's a sefer written on top. So they pick it up, and take them a while to realize, oh, this is a little bit different. As those are David Lipschitz, who read it, Love and Alaros. I love Lucius read it because the students were reading it, and he thought he had to. And it's right, it's right. Teachers have to read just about everything if they're going to deal with students seriously. How can you have a conversation with a student about something that he's read and you haven't? Okay, but I tend to think that the claim that Rashi didn't have this girsa is at least not compelling. Now the Sifri has an interesting reverses Lahavin Lahorot as to Lahorot to Lahavin. But the thing that interests me is, right, then you have the claim that it's actually just about Leshev Badin. Lots of people think that, just like people think, most people think that it's to learn. That's why I always think it's interesting that Rabbi Gamliel and especially the others actually engaged in Maasim, and not just to learn about it. Right, you have the Rabbeinu B'chayev, you know, claim the Chaim Matzida B'Shivim B'Sanhedrin Sheyitzrichim Liyot B'Kiyim B'Choach Chochmos Afilu B'Chochmos Akshafim. Right, so Sanhedrin had to know things comprehensively, but many of those things only learned B'Havin El-Horos. The Sikdus Utrasa extend this even to prohibitions where it says Al-Tifnu. Right, so Sikdus Utrasa says Al-Tifnu, right, even things where normally we have a barrier against doing anything at all, Al-Tifnu, right, it seems B'Havin El-Horos works. It doesn't even fall under the term of Pnea. Okay, the Sarah Pnea is an interesting thing that maybe you do it Dafka, it's not just members of Sanhedrin, you have to do it in advance because you're ambitious, you want to become a member of Sanhedrin. Right, that's an interesting thing, right? Because we could have a model where only people in Sanhedrin ever learn these things. And so the first thing you do when you become a member of Sanhedrin is you spend the next 10 years not learning Torah at all. Because you have to learn all these chachmos. Right, so the interesting model. You know, we have a model like that, right? If you want to be Rosh Hashiva, you have to get a doctorate. Right, that was sort of a feeling at YU at one point. Right, that was, you know, you want to be Rosh Hashiva, stop learning Torah. Well, you can get a doctorate in Jewish studies. That seems cheating. Well, that would be the. That's why the Torah is useful, because he seems to think that you do it in order, you know, that maybe you can do it because you have the ambitions of becoming a member of the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, but let's say you still can't be a member of the Sanhedrin.
Then the Sanhedrin might not apply, according to those shritas. Right, according to those shritas, that wouldn't...
Right. Well, what if you're a person who can't be a member of the Sanhedrin because you're a woman, so you don't have to stand the Torah?
Yeah.
Right,
so the question is, L'horot, right, what is Lavina L'horot? What is Lavina L'horot?
What
does it mean? Is it only on the highest level?
Why are you doing this?
I don't have the... Oh, gosh.
Right, so that I think is it. Pardon?
Can't learn Torah, and they can't learn other stuff, because they're not...
I don't say women can't learn Torah.
According to this discussion in class.
Yeah, I don't think
women
it's...
Women learn Torah, not in Laura.
What is it that we don't know? We're not allowed to know. Hey, tell me. Oh, not allowed to know that, and that, and that, and that. This is the...
Don't you dare talk about this far off the
Ramban. That's in Pirates of Penzance.
You have to start every show that way.
In Pirates of Penzance, when the Major General's daughters first come in, they sing a song about all the things they would never do with young men. All right, there's a listing. We would never do this, and of course we would never do that, and of course never, and never that.
Right.
Perhaps.
You just start every show that way. Of course, we would never actually teach Torah, but...
If you want to know what it was, right, here are the things that you should know. Okay. You have Rav Moshe Feinstein who draws this explicitly, right? He talks about whether you can hear Christian music. Right, so he says, "I'll call upon a din emes the lahavin lahoros leke yisur." I will mitzad heter ze ein lahatir l'gdoli hadora b'torah v'yirachmayim v'olistam bnei adam. So Moshe says, if you learn from a course that makes fun of it, so of course you can read a book. Of course you can read a book about witchcraft, as long as it explains why witchcraft is nonsense. And you can read a book about Rabbi Zohar. Now this.
Well, it's not making fun of it, but it's like talking about it in the context. Obviously, like now from our age, like we.
This is not a position that is congenial to modernism, where we tend to believe that you can never be sure. Right, just reading about something, right? People, very often, my image of this is there's a line that says that when John Donne preached against sin, so somebody said, sin never seemed so attractive as when Professor Donne preached against it. Because you'd have long, poetic descriptions of the sins that you shouldn't engage in. All with it explicitly, don't do this, right? For example, right, if a woman appears to you and she looks like this, right, and she engages in this, and then she does that, and then she does that, no, this is the wages of hell, don't do it. But even when she does this and that, no. Now the problem is that we have a little bit of cynicism because Dunn wrote poetry about this that wasn't part of his sermons, but right, and so the problem is whether it was Mikudash when he took his erotic poetry and he put it into his sermons as examples of the sin that you shouldn't engage in. Right? Does that really make it better? So I don't know. I have to say that Rav Moshe's notion that he came after things only to make fun of him, it just wouldn't work on me. That's the problem of projecting. It wouldn't work on me. Yes.
Well, right. The only other thing, the problem is when we get to a place where it seems like, right, there's a greater danger of people being, Husat and Huda from not being allowed to read the books than from being allowed to read the books. Right?
Yeah, there's also...
I know a lot of people who, if you tell them they can't read a book, then they won't read it and they'll go off the deret, right, because they'll just assume that, you're morally corrupt. Whereas if he doesn't read the book and they read it, they probably wouldn't because it's just not compelling.
Right. For me, I think that... it's a good thing that my teachers fought, and eventually I agreed not to read Myrna Vilchim in high school because it would have bored me to distraction. And happily, I didn't. I didn't get to read it until later when I could begin to appreciate it. Pedagogically, I don't think this works nowadays. I think it's a bad idea in many places. It didn't work for me. The metaphor for this is when I took Intro to Exegesis with Professor Carme. So he did a great job of making the documentary hypothesis appear absurd. And it probably worked for us to get a number of members in the class. To me, it stimulated me to go read it because I couldn't believe that intelligent people would believe something that looked as ridiculous as he made it. So obviously something was being hidden from me. Now how many students react that way and how many students just go off saying, oh, it's ridiculous and live the rest of their lives happily? I can't tell you. I suspect a lot of them do. It just doesn't work on me. So you have to figure out, right? You have to figure out how that works for students. Okay. The bigger question here, and that will be the transition perhaps to the dialogue between Professor Kaplan and Dr. Berger and Rabbi Parnas. But the question I want to ask is, we always have to ask whenever we have two categories, whether there is a middle category. If there's a middle category, which side of the line does it fall on? So what we know is that, let's say, it's usher to learn witchcraft for the purpose of engaging in witchcraft because you believe in it. And we know it's mutter to learn witchcraft in order to issue halachic rulings, or even in order to teach people about how to issue halachic rulings about witchcraft. What about learning lehavin but not lehorot? What about learning stuff because you believe that it has value, although not the value that the people who created it assigned to it? I'm not learning it to make it ridiculous, but I'm learning on the presumption that its beliefs are not true, but that nonetheless it has something to teach me. So this is not, right, this is not discussed. Right? What you have in literature is simply, right, is the Havina Lahorot is, right, so you can either the Havina Lahorot is saying, this is utterly usser, unless for some reason you need it for a very narrow purpose in Torah, specifically you need to paskin issues about this. The problem is sometimes it seems like you're using a cannon to shoot a flea, right? Because the chazanim are bekiyim, right? The chol minei mechashvim, the chazanim have to go learn every element of every other religion in the world. You're learning way too much, if that's what you need. The other way of learning it is to say that you can learn anything you want, so long as your learning of it has a positive Torah value. And lehavin and lehorot are examples. It might even be that lehavin doesn't mean to understand it so you can execute people for performing it, but it might mean to gain understanding of something, the world, human beings, beauty, whatever it may be. So I don't have any makoros
that make the extension. I also don't think that there are very many Mekorot that reverse it the other way. The interesting midline is about Refuah. Right? And so you can talk about which way the Refuah example seems to go. Does it tell you that Refuah, it's Aser? Or does it tell you that Refuah should in principle be Mutter, but in a particular case they discover that even for Refuah, it wasn't working? Maybe it's a case-by-case judgment. Right? What kinds of values are worth what kind of risks? Right? I would be happiest coming to some kind of conclusion like that, which is that you have to recognize that certain things have deep problems in where they tend. On the other hand, we don't want to deny you access to any source of truth. So make sure when you learn these things that you learn them Lahavin al-Horos. But Lahavin al-Horos doesn't just mean so you can be a Rav and Paskin these Shailas, although certainly it's an advantage for me, right? It's one of the positives of being a Rav with certain responsibilities in that regard is that it gives me a heter to learn all these things, so people might ask me Shailas about them. So it's a good way of sublimating it, right? Maybe becoming a rabbi if you have Yitzhara for learning these things is like becoming a shofet if you have Yitzhara for murder. Right? It gives you a kosher way of learning about all these things. But I tend to think not. But I do want to suggest that. I think. But again, this is a reading that doesn't have attestations elsewhere in tradition. I just don't think it's contradicted. That Lahavin al-Horot can be extended to mean learning for some positive religious purpose. And probably making Lahavin that is an example of drush. Although it'd be a cool drush, right? If everybody came out learning saying Lahavin al-Horot means that you can learn things so long as you remember that you have to keep right, that you're doing them L'shem Shemayim, and maybe even for Narot Talmud Torah, that would be fine. I find it hard to argue that's what it really meant, because I don't have any use where somebody just says Lahavin as opposed to, right, without an immediate practical purpose as opposed to Lahavin. But that may just be a broad issue of whether we have examples of, whether we have enough evidence of people learning things just for the sake of learning things Bichlal. What we do have, in addition to the statement about the Sanhedrin being Bikiyim, is we have the statements of the curriculum of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and or Hillel in various places, which suggests that they learned Davar Gadol b'Davar Katan, that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and it seems to suggest that they knew things which have no direct Torah purpose, and that was part of being a complete scholar. Right? To know Mishalot Shualim and Mishalot Kovsin. Right? Mishalot Shualim and Mishalot Kovsin are not Torah. Right? They're aspects of human culture that it seems to be that a comprehensive Torah scholar should know. I think Mishalot Shualim are lower... I think Mishalot Shualim is Aesop's Fables, and Mishalot Kovsin are lower class, right? Cockney slang, basically, is the equivalent, right? It's lower class humor. I can attest that to you at some other point, but I think that's what Mishalot Kovsin means. It means the kind of humor engaged in by manual laborers. So if you take that thesis, then Lahavin al-Horot becomes just a version of the sugya we had by Moshav Leitzim in terms of Shabbos, and the sugya we had by Al Tifnu Halilim by Dukni Atzmo, which is to say that there are many things which are valuable only if you do them for the right reason, and also if you do them for the wrong reason. There are some things which aren't dangerous, and so you can do them perhaps even if their value is trivial, and there are some things which are dangerous, and you can only do them if their value is great. Right, that's what I want to set out as a potential language. To make Lahavin al-Horot, and this is a variant of the general non-Orthodox attempt to give substantive weight to what appear to be pragmatic principles. Right, it's the same as the claim that Darkei Shalom, Mishum Eiva, are not compromises, but fundamental principles. Darkei Shalom means you should behave in such a way that, right, it's not that really you should do this, but you have to consider it because of social peace, that there's a positive worth in doing things that produce social peace. That Mishum Eva doesn't mean that if you do this, they'll kill you, which it means that you shouldn't behave in such a way that people will legitimately want to kill you. Right? So Lahavin al-Horot doesn't mean, of course these things are automatically valueless, but you can do them in order to kill people, right? You can learn them in order to kill people for having learned them. Right? What it means is that you can learn these things if you feel that you will understand more as a result. Okay, that's the overall thesis you can, that I'm setting out, and I hope that it's useful in providing a language. And I also gave you the dialogue between Rav Parnas and Professor Berger and Professor Kaplan, whom I should say nice things about all of them. But I did benefit from Rav Parnas this year, and very appreciative. Actually, he sent me a very nice greeting a while back. I was very appreciative of that. And Professor Kaplan, who is another one who can tell the story, who has tremendous appreciation of his academic integrity. And Professor Berger, you all know, I would say for years, I hope he doesn't listen to the tape, that when people ask something, what should a modern Orthodox Jew be like? And that's what we said. But, pardon? Professor Berger? Well, now he's the dean of Yeshiva College, isn't he?
I mean, I just remember the guy who
was
like the
Chabad. Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate.
He's
dean of Revel now?
Yeah.
Wasn't he dean of YC for a while? No, he's dean of Revel. Okay. Any case.
Much to...
Some of us are from YU.
Okay. They're all from... Professor Kaplan is the translator of Halachic Manus, the way you probably know him. And Berger was a great Jewish historian and a fine Halakha. And Rav Parnas was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU when I was there. So now I think he just retired. At Landers. But Rav Parnas sort of enjoyed setting himself up as the anti-Torah Mada figure. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. He once spent the entire shiur setting up a joke, which he told us a story about how when he was in college, he read the introduction to some math textbook, because he had this college in high school as a teacher who gave him extra books. He never read the extra books, but he gave him this math textbook, and this math textbook had an introduction, and he decided once he should pick it up, and he read the introduction, and the introduction it said that you can never stand still, you can either go forward or go backwards. And we're like thinking, like, why is he not like this thing? And the whole point of it at the end was he just looked at us after this 25-minute story and said, who says I'm not Torah Mada? It was just there. It was just there to shock us. But if I enjoyed setting people up, setting himself up that way, I still have a great deal. I get Schadenfreude by, he walked into Thursday afternoons with the Parsha Shiras, whenever we get mad. And so he walked in one day and said, okay, Rabotai, today we're going to talk about Eschalta de Gula. Somebody define it. And the rest of the share was people yelling at Plektik, and he said, nope, I don't hear, it doesn't make any sense to me, no formulation. Sorry, so, the engineer, well, it doesn't seem to exist, so we can just walk away. No need to respond. I was very oppositional. So this article was very much in character. I'm not going to say anything against it, I'm just going to tell you that it's the Perusha Rambam that contradicts the whole idea. You can deal with it, I'm not saying anything, I'm just reading the Rambam. It was very, very much. Really, very Lamisha Amram. And so that's what he said, he read the article, he said, look, the Rambam says that in Israel, 50 will live. And it seems that extends to Minas as well. And guess what? Lots of books you read have a Vodazara and Minas in them. Fira. So what's the heter? And particularly, I say, right, the notion that we believe that there's a right to all knowledge, and that you can't constrain philosophic inquiry in advance. Right? How can you say that? The Rambam says you can. Okay? So the question everybody asked about that, of course, is, what do you mean? You're going to tell me the Rambam didn't think about these issues? How could he tell you not to think about them if he didn't think about them? Right, so this is Rasadigon. Rasadigon says that in order to believe something, you have to first doubt it. You have to engage in Cartesian doubt. So, right, so Farnes says, oh yeah, but that was Lavin Lahoros. Lavin Lahoros, right, thinks how much of that would be us or otherwise. So you can only think about these things if you're engaged in Lavin Lahoros. And that, of course, is only for specialized people for about it. So Professor Berger and Professor Kaplan have a response which is not so nogea necessarily to what we're saying, where they claim is that what the Rambam meant is that things are usher for people until they're ready for them. And you have to figure out an appropriate pedagogy to figure out who's ready to think about what when. The Haraya, the Rambam talks about these things all the time everywhere else. if you're really not supposed to think about these things, then the best solution for you is not to read the Rambam. Certainly not to read the Morah. Right, how are you going to read the Morah without the right? For that matter, it's hard to learn Torah without thinking about these things, so the Torah brings them up all the time. And that, I think, is a very good common sense response, right? It's two levels of response. One level of response is the Rambam couldn't have meant that because he thought about that himself. So Aquinas had an easy response to that. That was loving Lahoros. And the second thing is the Rambam taught this to other people. That I don't think Aquinas has such a good response to. Aquinas just says, well, you know what? I have a Rambam. You have to read it. And we don't have a very good way of reading it. The deeper question underlying it is, because Rav Parnas uses this to attack the notion that there can be fields that, in the interest of truth, deny any a priori halakhic restrictions. Right, so Rav Parnas argues this about philosophic inquiry, but one could make the same claim about imagination. Right, so, now, you could make the distinction within Rav Parnas and say, no, the Torah doesn't ban, doesn't intend to ban inquiry, but it bans writing down the stuff. Because you can't write down these thoughts in the same way. If you have elements, you can imagine what things look like, but you're still bound by halakha rather than draw them. Right? That's all there as well. But it seems to me that it's possible that some artists experience painting the way some of us, and this I more include myself, experience philosophy. Right, which is to say that it's a mode of exploring truth, and you can't restrain it in advance. So I'm not sure which way we learn from that. Right? Whether we learn that we should really restrain philosophy, or that we make a claim that you can think about all the philosophy you want, but you can't write it down even for yourself. You can't even take notes, let alone write books for other people. Or maybe not. Maybe we say that, you know what, as long as you don't reach conclusions that are explicit, that say explicitly God is, God doesn't exist, whatever it may be, there has to be freedom to engage in the pursuit of truth, and maybe, at least to some extent, that applies to the visual and imaginative search for truth in the same way it applies to the rationalist search for truth. Right? So I want to hold that out as a possibility, that to some degree the rhetoric about artistic freedom is not that different than the rhetoric about philosophic freedom. And it may be that those of us who are biased towards finding space for philosophic freedom should also be biased towards finding space for artistic freedom. And the last thing I want to point out...
Unless we think that there's no reason to.
Unless we think there's no reason to. Yeah. The last thing I want to say is that what always amused me about the dialogue between Rav Parnas and Professors Berger and Kaplan is that Rav Parnas says that, look, there's a Rambam. You're going to tell me how the Rambam does anything, says anything different, but how the Rambam behaves differently, I'll tell you the Rambam engaged in Islavin al-Horos. Okay? And Professor Berger and the Kaplan say, no, that's not really the only heter. But what really always interests me is that the Rambam, halacha, doesn't quote the Teretz of Islavin al-Horos. Ever. Right? He may have had that Girsa in the Gemara. He may have paskened against it. Yes, they'll confirm with you. Hannah Stone.
Thank you.
It always struck me as fascinating about that conversation is that everyone seems to assume, of course, Lavin al-Horos is the heter. But the Rambam doesn't quote it. Doesn't quote it. The question is, what does that mean? So you could say that means that it's Asher Legamrei. But on the other hand, I think even reporters would have trouble saying that the Rambam thought it was absolutely usher to read all these things he told you was usher to read, but had read. Very hard. Maybe it creates room to think that the Rambam didn't, that the Rambam had a broader notion, and he thought the Heter didn't depend on Lavin al-Horos. Right? Maybe it actually, right? Once you know that you can't use Lavin al-Horos in the technical sense of the Gemara as the way out of that, because the Rambam doesn't quote it, that means the Rambam must have had some other kind of Heter for reading this material. Maybe that heter was the Rambam thought that it was inconceivable, that it wouldn't be possible to pursue truth, so long as you have another.
That's the truth, then it's the Torah.
Because ultimately, it will be
the Torah. The Torah is true, right?
Ultimately, that's the Sadegon's argument. Ultimately, all truth has to come from God. But this is a path. Right? We're talking about the path to truth. Right? So I suggest. Right? It always struck me
that it was astounding that the critiques of Farnes didn't point that out. The Rambam doesn't quote this. And it's not my chiddush, right? It's not my chiddush, the Rambam. Other people have noticed the Rambam doesn't quote it in a different context. And it seems to me plausible that the reason the Rambam doesn't quote it is that he doesn't need a heter like that. Right? Because he thinks that it's obvious that there cannot be constraints. Albeit, the Rambam believes perhaps more starkly than we do. Well, that's an interesting question. That you can classify very sharply what kind of things, which kind of people are ready for. And the Rambam believes very much in structuring education that way so that when you're ready for something, you present it to them. We have, I think, in America at least, a more democratizing tendency. And we also have books that are widely available, so it's very hard to censor that way. If you have a book in the Beis Medrash, it's very hard to tell some students you can't read that one. But I want to thread, so the summary is, in terms of Manae Ilan Zeh, I think that the pshat is irrelevant almost right. It's almost any issue of art value. Even within those interpretations that see it as relevant, there are positions that see it as having value, so long as you don't let that value compete with Torah. And furthermore, right, then you have a broad array of readings that much more philosophic thing that see the clash between aesthetics and rationalism as primordial, so to speak, as rooted in the nature of humanity. But it's not necessarily so clear that that means that that the solution nowadays is to deny the aesthetic as opposed to find a way of redeeming it. We have Rav Lichtenstein's, I think wonderful way of turning the Mishnah into a manifesto the other way, which then I think there Rav Jachter was very interesting. Rav Jachter was willing to say, Rav Lichtenstein said it, so that's how I saw it. Right? That's what it means for us. I'm more an originalist, but you can take Rav Jachter's position as opposed to mine. In terms of the range of Levina Laharot, right, so you have the possibility that Levina Laharot is just a narrow heter. You have the possibility, I'm suggesting, that Levina Laharot just means that you can't do this for reasons which aren't worth it. And finally, I'm suggesting that maybe the fact that the Rambam doesn't quote Levina Laharot means that there is a broader heter, which fundamentally acknowledges that you have to seek truth wherever you can find it, and whichever way you can find it. But you always have to be mechashev schar mitzvah keneged hesed, and hesed mitzvah keneged schara, and make sure and see that you make choices that are worthwhile. Okay, that's for today. Sorry, I don't know if you just came in to hear that. That's what we're done. Tomorrow we do whatever it is that Makor are on for tomorrow, which hopefully are correct. Housekeeping thing. No.
What are we supposed to do?